Welcome to the Ray Harryhausen Podcast, the show dedicated to the life, career and films of a special effects titan. Join us as we host in-depth discussions about the work, influences and legacy of this uniquely talented filmmaker. Brought to you by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, we will be delving into Ray's archive to bring a unique insight into his work, including exclusive audio from the man himself. We will be joined by special guests for retrospectives, exclusive announcements and competitions, so this podcast is a must-listen for all fans of the world of Ray Harryhausen, animation and classic filmmaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 48 of the Ray Harryhausen podcast, or episode 16 if you're watching this on YouTube, of the Ray Harryhausen vodcast. My name is Connor Heaney. I'm the collections manager for the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, and I'm joined as always by trustee, author and filmmaker John Walsh. Hello, John.
Hi, Connor. It's great to be here chatting on the vodcast podcast. And it's great that we've got a very special guest for people to listen and watch with today, Arnie Leibovitz. And Arnie has, as many people will know, has been responsible for looking after, really, the George Powell archive. So he's like the Connor Heaney, but for George Powell, but not here in America, which is fabulous stuff. And although there isn't a massive archive of stuff as there is for the Harryhausen Foundation, he is really the go-to person to speak to about George Powell. If you love The Time Machine and you love War of the Worlds and all those other great films, The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau, then he's your man to speak to. But of course, he's been involved in this marvelous physical restoration of the Puppetoon series, which is now having a third volume, Colin. Is that right?
Yes, volume three of the Puppetoons has just been released on Blu-ray, and it's a fantastic collection. The Puppetoons have been hard to track down for many years now. They've been hard to find if you're a fan of these charming animations by George Powell. And this is of special interest to Ray Harryhausen fans because the Puppetoons hold a very special place in Ray's biography. This was his first paid employment as a young animator. He worked on a lot of these films, and Puppetoons Volume 3 features Western Days, which is actually the first piece of commercial animation that Ray ever worked upon when he was 20 years old. So an important piece of film history here, a fantastic collection of short films, and fantastic work by Arnie in restoring and making these long-lost movies available again. And the Puppetoons are beloved. They're a very special type of animation, which I think Arnie will get into in more detail in our conversation. But really important that these animation archivists around the world are making this available and really bringing history to life again.
Three cheers! The Puppetoons are back! Before Oscar winner George Powell made movies like The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds, he created Puppetoons, amazing stop-motion animated shorts that thrilled audiences the world over. Now, all can rejoice as even more Puppetoons, not seen in generations, return, fully restored from their original Technicolor negatives, featuring Punchy and Judy, Dr. Seuss, Jim Dandy, and Rusty. Plus, the first animation work by Ray Harryhausen. So trip back to that wondrous time and relive again Powell's one-of-a-kind Puppetoons.
So, Arnold, thanks for joining us today. It's wonderful to have you on the Ray Harryhausen podcast. It's a natural home for you to be here because of the work you're doing with George Powell's films and the Puppetoons. It's about to have its volume three on Blu-ray, and it looks spectacular. How did you get involved first, if I may ask, with George Powell?
Well, the Odyssey began, I guess you could say, I can start with childhood, of course, but I'll first start with a more recent meeting of George. And it happened back around 1978 or 79, I think it was. I was working on a feature film, a monster film called The Descendant. And It had a Ray Harryhausen kind of animation to it. And I had reached out to a lot of people to work with me on the project, Jim Danforth and Dave Allen and Ray himself, actually. And was friends with Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien.
Yes.
And it was just at the time that Alien was coming out, and I was very friendly with him, and we spent time together, and he was helping with my project. And he said, you know, maybe you should take it to George Powell. And I obviously had grown up with George Powell. I was very influenced by George. I really hadn't been keeping track of him in the later years. And so I said, absolutely. And so he put me in touch with George. It was actually through Jim Danforth, as I remember. And so I met with George at his house in Beverly Hills and brought the project to him. And he was the most delightful, charming, wonderful man that you can possibly imagine. I could hardly believe I was sitting in his living room at the time. He had the book that Gail Hickman had written called The Films of George Powell was on the desk on his table. His Oscars were over here. There was some Puppet Tunes over here. And, you know, it was quite overwhelming to me. But he was just such a sweet man. And he was so open to the project. He was so interested. I was interested in getting Rod Taylor to play the part. And he said, oh, yeah, we can get Rod, you know. But he has to lose a little weight, he would say, you know. So he was very, very helpful. And he had kind of gave me his advice on it and so forth. The problem being, it was the last year of his life. And it was only about a year later, I think, that he passed away. So I stayed in touch with him during that time. And it was when he died, I was really struck by that. You know, it was sometimes in your life, you know, I've known a lot of people, but for some reason, when George died, it made a big impression on me. It was very earth changing. I was friends with Mrs. Powell afterwards for almost 25 years after that. She almost became my second mother in many ways. She opened the doors for me in the industry, and she did so much to help me. So that's sort of how the George Powell, film on George Powell, the fantasy film world of George Powell.
She's brilliant. I love that. Yes.
Thank you. It's on YouTube now. I have it running right now. People are interested. That premiered at the Academy, the Motion Picture Academy. And that was followed up with the Puppet Tunes. And it's quite a long story. I mean, all the details of every single project, how it happened, the process. And I would say that it was one of those things in your life that you'd have to call a bit of a miracle project in a way. It was sort of serendipity because it wasn't planned by me. It wasn't something I had planned, something I had sought out. It was all quite accidental, the whole thing. It developed into a life-changing part of my life, the biggest part of my life, really.
Let me just interrupt there and ask you, because we look after Ray Harryhausen's materials here between myself, Vanessa's daughter, and Connor. Is it fair to say that you look after George Powell's kind of archive and collection? You are the kind of the gatekeeper for George Powell's archive.
Some people say that. Some people, I'm saying I'm the unofficial keeper of the flame, so to speak. And I have been doing that. I've been trying that to do that over the years in the best way I can. And it's great because in the sense of the Puppet Tunes, a lot of these films haven't been seen in decades and generations, really. And they've never been seen this good before. And so this is kind of an exciting time to be able to come to the point where the technology has merged with the possibilities of being able to exhibit these things And my hope is they'll be seen in theaters, in movie theaters. We definitely things to talk about there, because there's nothing like seeing these films on the screen, obviously, especially restored. So that's awfully important. My association with Ray, since that's a big part of the topic, I was kind of in on this with Ray very early on. I mean, I'm going back probably 35 years at least. And I was in touch with Ray even before I met George. I was in touch with him because of this movie I was working on. And I actually was in touch with Charles Schneer. And it kind of started with Schneer, and then it led to Ray in many ways. I was very interested in having Ray work on this project. Schneer was very protective of Ray, and I can't say that it was going to be an easy process to get Ray to do it, really. He would had his own plans of things he wanted to do. But I always feel on a personal side that Charles Schneer doesn't quite always get the credit he deserves in this process. And I'm not taking anything away from Ray, and I definitely want to talk a great deal about it. It's just that Schneer was, I think Ray was very lucky to have someone like Schneer it's not easy to make films. It's not easy to put it all together. And although I know that Ray and Charles Schneer had a stormy relationship, I think that he was extremely helpful to him, being able to really give him the platform that he needed to do the great things that he did. And so I just wanted to say that. And as far as Ray is concerned, Ray was making regular visits to Los Angeles during that time. He was visiting Darlene, Willis O'Brien's wife, second wife, and he would regularly come to Los Angeles to do that. Ray and Deanna were really world travelers. I mean, they seemed to go everywhere. And Ray was wonderful because he had this, he loved the people. He really loved being with the fans, being with the people that admired him. And yet he was such a nice man. He was so giving and very open about everything. So one remarkable thing about Ray, very accessible, very relatable, very easy to talk to. And so when I was planning to do my film on George, it was an instantaneous amongst the many, many people that I worked with on these projects that were involved with George. Ray was very, very open and helpful. And we spent a great deal of time together. He came to visit me here in Sedona. I live in Sedona, Arizona. And he was fascinated that I was here. And he stayed with me here during that time, showed him around and everything. And Deanna was here, and then also in Los Angeles, you know, we had spent a lot of time together. He loved George. I know you probably want to ask me about this.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So because for people listening who don't know the full story, of course, Ray Harryhausen worked on Puppetoons, and it was through George Powell that Ray got the chance to do that. And of course, Ray wanted at some point to make his own version of War of the Worlds. And of course, famously, George Powell created the cinematic classic War of the Worlds and The Time Machine, which we'll talk about a bit later on as well. But yes, I mean, it is fascinating that two men who were so alike as well. They had similar personalities, didn't they? They got on so well. Unusual people to find in a creative industry where people are quite sort of hard-edged, would you say, Arnie?
I think that's a very good point. If and when you get the Puppetoon 3, I've included expanded interviews with Ray, along with 6 or 7 other people like Gene Roddenberry and Rod Chang and Russ Tamblyn and Joe Dante and many other, Roy Disney. Ray talked about, he made that very point. He was talking about how in the industry, everything is so, you know, business and, you know, the creative isn't always allowed to express themselves. And he said working at the Puppetoon studios for him and being with George was, not only was it his first break in Hollywood, because that was the first thing he did. So George had done that for him, and he was always grateful for that. He learned so much, but it was the environment. He loved the working environment of the Puppetoons. And of course, I've heard this from many, many of the people that worked at the Puppetoons, because I knew a lot of these people when they were alive. Many of the Puppetoon animators have all, unfortunately, passed away now. They all expressed how much they loved the Puppetoon studios. There was nothing quite like it anywhere in the world. It was a free environment, a creative environment. There were many languages spoken from people from all over the world. George was an equal opportunity employer. He had people working from all over the world at a very early stage. Plus women work there, different people from different countries work there. All these craftsmen and artists. Bob Baker talked to me about that. Many of them did, of how extraordinary the Puppetoon studio was. And Ray loved it. He loved being there. He learned a great deal at the studio. He talked to me about life is always so interesting, how you never know where you're going to pick up various pieces of information to advance your creative ideas. And he thought that the time at the Puppetoon studio for him was so informative because George was doing something that he had never done before. Because as you know, I can go into detail, but Ray was doing the armature puppet, obviously. I mean, he was very much it was really Willis O'Brien, as we know, that was his mentor. And so he was working with a single armature, and as most animators were, really. But George comes along and comes up with this process, this replacement figure process, meaning for every frame of film, there was a separate puppet made basically to capture the action of stop motion. And it was all pre-designed and pre-constructed. It was all done in George's head. He completely imagined it in advance and then made these director sheets, elaborate director sheets with every single move of the puppet done in advance. In advance. So it's not like you're with the puppet and you decide, well, I think we should move a little this way or that way, or maybe he's got some. No. He had it all designed in his mind that this is the way it would be. This would be a pre-designed idea. So for Ray, that was a complete revelation. I mean, and for most of the animators, they'd never done anything like that before.
Arnie, would it be fair to say that might restrict an animator who wants to do a performance and have a creature looking one way or the other, or a classic Harryhausen style pose?
Yes, absolutely. It could be restrictive. And I think that's what happened. Eventually the animators wanted more freedom and they wanted to have more control. And eventually Puppetoons, they started to get into more of the armature. When John Henry and the Inky Poo was made, they started to move more into armature puppetry. So it was really a natural evolution. But with that said, you have to admire the astonishing craft that was done that Pal did in those early years, and the look of it, the stylized quality of animation that he was able to achieve with the replacement figure puppet is really unparalleled in terms of its style and look and so forth. And Ray talked about how, again, his thing was, you know, obviously seeing King Kong and The Lost World, and how it affected him so greatly in his future thinking and animation. He was always into realism. He was always into a realistic idea of dinosaurs and monsters and so forth. The Puppetoons were never designed to be that. The Puppetoons were pure fantasy. It was designed to be a cartoon fantasy world, really.
Very stylized, and yeah.
Very stylized. So it's hard to make that comparison to say this and that. It's a completely unique style unto its own. It has its own place. And so in a way, George created a brand. He created a separate kind of category in the world of animation. It's a separate category. And so that's what makes them so unique.
So can I ask you, Arnie, who commissioned the Puppetoon films, and where were they distributed, and who was the exhibitor? Because this is a time when for people who are working in cinema, it's tricky, because there's a relationship between the studio who finances you, the exhibitor, and the distributor. So there's so many moving parts. So how did George Powell kind of settle on his style, and how did that fit in with what people wanted that were the money men?
Well, George was kind of in a fortunate situation. In Europe, he had already done, he was already working, I would say a good 10 years or more easily in Europe before he ever came to the United States. So because of George establishing himself in Europe, he was called the Walt Disney of Europe at the time. He was very well known. His films were shown in movie theaters, just like commercials were shown in television today. They were story films. And he was commissioned by various commercial companies. Phillips, of course, was the most famous, but he had done it for a whole host of companies. I guess I should go back a little bit and just give a little history to this. First, George was born in Hungary, people that may not know. He was born in Budapest. He was born to an actor's family, but he said he didn't want to have anything to do with the stage. He wanted to do something else. But believe me, the stage found him. He was probably the most dramatic, person you could possibly imagine in the arts. But that was the way he put it. So he became an architect. He went to the Budapest Academy of the Arts, and but it was that times weren't very good. The economy wasn't very good. He said there was nothing to build. So he became a cartoonist because he knew how to draw. He was a carpenter. He knew how to draw. So he became a cartoonist. The cartooning led to doing posters and cartooning. And then he went into animation. And then he worked for Hunia in Budapest, and then met Mrs. Powell, Joka, his wife, and then they moved to Germany, and then he worked at UFA and became the head. This is important. He had become the head of the animation department at UFA. UFA was one of the largest, if not the largest, film studios in Europe and in Germany. And so he had a great advantage. He was well regarded. George was very well regarded, and people sought after him to do these various films. They came to him for these things to do, see. So he kind of established his own, like I say, his own brand in a way. And then the Phillips Company offered him a job to come to Eindhoven, to the Netherlands, to make his story films in Holland. And he made, he was there for years doing that. He was also staying one step ahead of the Nazis, because the Nazis had invaded the countries, and they were after him, and he was always having to stay one step ahead of them. And that was a big effect on George. That's a whole separate story. And he eventually left Holland, came to the United States just before the Nazis invaded Holland oddly enough. So he was able to escape just by the skin of his teeth, and he didn't even realize it was going to happen so fast, but he suspected it. And so to answer your question, going back a little bit to figure this out, Paramount really saw the Puppetoons. He had been seen in the United States. George had come over. He had lectured at Columbia University. Walt Disney knew about him. He was already getting a certain gravitas in the United States. And so they really sought George. And Paramount said, we want you to make Puppetoons for us at Paramount. And so as far as the financing is concerned and the that whole part of it, he was in demand. George was in demand. They wanted him to do it. So for him, it was relatively easy because he was the only one doing anything like it in the world. Frankly, there was no one else. As Ray told me, he said, I mean, it wasn't until George came along in the United States and set up his Puppetoon studios that there was able actually a place that was doing dimensional animation because it never existed before. He basically did the same thing in Europe in many extent, setting up his own full facility. So in a way, so during that time, he was well financed by the studio. To answer your question.
Yeah. It's surprising in a way, isn't it? When we think about the innovations that Walt Disney made at the time and the people he worked with, like Peter Ellenshaw, who's English and, in fact, grew up down the road from me. He was born in Eltham in South London. That he didn't try and capture George Powell for himself, for the Walt Disney Company, and as it were, control that side of dimensional animation as well. Was there ever any sort of tension there or headhunting with George? Because it seems like a Walt Disney thing to do, wouldn't it?
It's his most definitely. Walt Disney and George Powell were very good friends right from the start. I was very lucky to have known several of the nine old men. Of course, I was friends with Roy Disney for about 30 years. And I was also friends with Ward Kimball, who created Jiminy Cricket, Mark Davis, who created Tinkerbell, Frank Thomas and Allie Johnson, who did Bambi and Fantasia and Dumbo and you name it. And they all saw the Puppetoons. I mean, George's Puppetoons were shown regularly at the studio. Walt brought them in for all the animators to see. George's Puppetoons were greatly influencing Walt Disney personally and how in his films it was influencing Walt Disney, because Walt was interested in three-dimensionality, as you know. He wanted to expand the animated flat cartoon into three dimensions. And here George comes along doing it in real time, right before your eyes. And he was like astounded, as were the animators, because that's what he wanted to do, and eventually became audio animatronics and everything else. But certainly in animation, that's what Snow White and Pinocchio and all the films are about, is dimensionality. So absolutely. Roy had told me, and I know this from the other animators, sure, he absolutely wanted to hire George. Of course he did. And they had a wonderful relationship. They met for lunches every month. I was told by George and also by Mrs. Powell, there was a group of animators, that all the heads of the animation studios in Hollywood, whether it was Leon Schlesinger at Warner Brothers and Basusto, I think at MGM, George and Walt and George and Walter Lantz. They all were friends, and they would get together for lunches. And by the way, Walter was a huge, big friend of George's and helped him with the citizenship papers and everything else. So Walter was had a big role in George's career and life. But that's the way it was. They all met together and they would trade stories. They would talk about what they were working on. They would trade animators. It was a Hollywood that doesn't really exist anymore. Things were done in a handshake. There was a certain creative freedom and friendship amongst these people. And so they all kind of worked together. George was unique because he was doing something that no one was doing. No one was doing dimensional animation, as I said, except George. So he was no threat to the animators because it was such a fresh new thing that it was an open door, really, for them to come to the Puppetoon studios and to work. And so you had people from Disney, from Warner Brothers, from the other studios working at the Puppetoon studios. There's good examples of that in several of the subjects that I can talk about, the various people that work there, if you want me to elaborate.
So would you say because of the closeness of the relationship between Walt and George, that they decided not to make projects together? They didn't have co-productions. They weren't doing anything creatively in the studios. Is that because they valued their friendships too much, would you say?
That, and I think George was his own Walt Disney. You know, he really yes. was his, he really was. He was the Walt Disney of his type of work and special effects. I mean, after all, even in features, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was George's project. Walt and him had that kind of relationship where, you know, they kind of was a kind of a friendly thing. Well, if you're not going to do it, I'll do it type thing. And George said, fine. I mean, you know, George is working on War of the Worlds and all these other projects. And okay, so I don't get to do 20,000 Leagues, but I'll get to do something else. You know, it was like, it wasn't the competition thing. It wasn't quite such a, you know, the kind of way it is today. It was, remember, it was all done by the creatives in a way. It was all sort of done, it wasn't like a studio, it wasn't the bottom line studio that's saying, do this, do that. It was the creatives that were kind of coming up with these things. They drove much of this. It wasn't until later years, more recently in the past few decades, where the studio has become more of the bastion of control and doing everything, almost like Madison Avenue with commercials. It was very different back then. There was more opportunity for the studio system, was a lot of opportunity for people to learn their craft, to work in the studio, to do things, to try out stuff. You didn't have to come up with a hit on your first project. You know, you could work your way up from the low guy doing a, you could be an assistant director or a cameraman or some, and then you could work your way up to being an assistant director or a producer or a editor or whatever. It was just a completely different business, to be frank, completely different business than it is today.
So going to the Puppetoons themselves, Arnie, sorry, how were they distributed then? Would they be shown alongside other films as a support feature in cinemas? And who would make that decision?
Well, Paramount had their own shorts division, as did Universal, Woody Woodpecker, the Fleischers, which was also Paramount. Each cartoon unit was at each studio. And remember, this was the time when short subjects were king. I mean, you'd go to a movie theater, you would see maybe one or two features, you'd see a newsreel, you'd see a cartoon, you'd see all sorts of things. It was there was no television, there was no other avenues to watch things. So when you went to a movie theater, it was an event. It was an event. You got dressed up, you brought your family. It was the biggest thing in your life was to go to a motion picture movie theater to see the world. And the world came to you in the form of motion picture films, shorts, newsreels, feature films, whatever. The Puppetoons were one of those. Puppetoons came out in 1940. That's when they came out in the United States. And the first one was called Western Days, which was 1940, 1941. That was Ray's first job, by the way, in Hollywood. He did Western Days, and he worked as one of the animators on that film. It's a magnificent Puppetoon. It's on volume 3, by the way, and it's restored. It's jaw-dropping, to say the least. And it's a successive negative. And those were shown in movie theaters. Now, I've had discussions with people over the years. Many of them have passed away. who were in, were alive to see the Puppetoons shown in movie theaters. And it was really staggering for people. Put yourself in a time machine for a minute. Go back in time and think of what it was like to be in a movie theater, say in 1933, for instance, or, you know, and suddenly you having musicals and, you know, westerns and dramatic movies, mostly plays were done as movies. Most films were just plays. And suddenly, or musicals, and then suddenly King Kong comes on the screen. I mean, if you could put yourself in, if you could somehow, it's, I know it's impossible for people today, but if you could put yourself in that place and imagine what that was like, it's unimaginable. That's the effect that that could have on a person. And that's what happened to Ray, of course. The same thing with the Puppetoons. You're having musicals and dramas and comedies and black and white, some are in color. And all of a sudden, this three-dimensional cartoon comes on the screen in brilliant Technicolor with stylized cartoon puppets in three dimension. And people that I spoke to, they couldn't believe it. It was the most astounding thing to see for them. And they couldn't wait to see other Puppetoons. They were very successful. Paramount had George making one after the other, after the other, after the other. It went on for years. He did over 40 or 50 of them. They were very successful in theaters until times changed. But the distribution of them was quite big. The Puppetoons were a big deal, not to be underestimated.
You're saying Technicolor, yes. Arnie, as well. Many feature films would, of course, been in black and white at the time. So how was George able to get the funding for shooting in Technicolor? Because it was a much more expensive process than it was, say, in the sort of 60s and 70s, as we understand it. Three-strip Technicolor is quite a kerfuffle, isn't it?
It is. It was expensive, and it was a very big deal. And the financing came from Paramount. It was never a question. It was never a question in terms of Paramount's commitment to the Puppetoons, as far as I can tell. It kind of went back to the executives at the studio when they first saw George's early work. George had made a film in Europe called Phillips Broadcast of 1938. It was shown at the San Francisco World's Fair. And you know how World's Fairs generally try to exhibit new technologies and new ideas? Well, George's Puppetoon represented an advancement in the world of technology. And so it was a highlight of the San Francisco World's Fair. And it was seen by corporations. Major corporations were there, like General Motors and General Electric and all these big companies from all over the world, including Philips in Europe. And that film was seen by people at Walt Disney Studios. It was seen by Hua Chang, for instance. That's how Hua Chang first became familiar with the Puppetoons, was when he saw it at the San Francisco World's Fair. This was an innovation. This was a pioneering innovation at the time, which really changed the landscape of motion picture and cinema in that time frame in a big, big way. And we can see the evolution of that kind of cartoon animation in recent years. I was brought into the Walt Disney Studios because of Roy and because of other friends. I had made the Puppetoon movie in 1987. And I basically reintroduced the Puppetoons to a world audience that hadn't seen the Puppetoons in 50 years. They hadn't seen them except maybe on television in black and white, if at all. And so from their point of view, it was seeing it for the very first time. And so reintroducing the Puppetoons really influenced the evolution of computer-generated imagery, because I was there when it happened. I met with Disney before they made Toy Story, for instance. I came in as an advisor to the studio to talk about the Puppetoons and how it was done. And this was before Toy Story was made, you see.
Yeah.
So the Puppetoons played an instrumental role in influencing Pixar in the making of Toy Story, and very much so with Nightmare Before Christmas. I was there when they shot it. And the Puppetoons were seen by all the animators. It was replacement figure, by the way. Tim Burton is a huge George Powell fan.
Right, yes.
And so that was replacement figure puppetry. And I was there, I saw all the puppets, and they were all had copies of the Puppetoon movie. They all watched it.
Oh.
It was almost like an education for them. So there's these pieces which show the influence, which is so amazing to me, is how it has gone on and on and on. It just seems like there's constant evolution. Just like with Ray, where Ray was a trendsetter with the armature puppet and monsters and that whole thing, whole aspect of it, George had his place as well. So I'd like to get back to Ray in a minute, but I don't mean to.
No, that's fine. So bringing it sort of up to date then, you talked about briefly there about, what did you say, an intermediate negative was used? Because I'm fascinated to know about the original camera material, the original camera negs possibly that you used for these restorations, because a lot of the studios don't have negs, they use interpositives. When they say original camera neg, they don't mean, they mean the materials they have in their archive, because negs are often not kept because of cement joins and so on. So how did you first knock on the door and say, look, I want to try and get these out onto HD, and do you have decent material for me?
Oh boy, what a question. That is such a great question. I have been seeking this for my whole life. I mean, you have to remember, I'm 73 now. Okay, now I've been at this since I was in my late 20s. And it's really been a lifelong mission for me to try to get these films seen and restored. Problem was, is that the Puppetoons have been in hands of other people. They left Paramount back in the late 1940s, and George didn't want to buy them. George was always looking beyond. He always wanted to do what was coming next. He was an artist. He wanted to take off his short pants, as he called it, put on his long pants, features, and make features. So for him, it didn't matter. He said, okay, we'll let the Puppetoons go. I'm going to incorporate them into my feature films. And so the Puppetoons lay there with various companies in various forums. The library was broken up and it was sold to this company and that company. And the negatives kind of went from company to company. But remember, the negatives existed, which is so rare, because you pointed that out. Even the Fleischers, even some of these early the negatives don't exist, and successive negatives don't exist. Only for certain films, the majority of films, they don't exist. The fact that the successive negatives exist at all and have been preserved by these various companies over the past 50, 60, 70 years is a miracle, to be perfectly honest. It's a miracle. And when they finally went back to Paramount, which happened, and I was after this for years, that was the beginning of the possibilities. It took me another 20 years, but you know, at the time, finally, the executives allowed me to do this, but I was able to access the successive negatives, the three strips, basically.
And were they cut negs? Sorry, Arnie, were they cut negs, or what position were they in? Because they were animation. Were the negatives cut?
They're successive. They're all on a single, strip of film is what it is. A successive negative, it's one strip of film where there's a blue for one frame, a green, and a red. So it's blue, red. It's like three frames for each single frame of film. And it's all put on one continuous strip. And that's what the successive negative is. That's how it's shot. And I can explain it to your listeners, if you're interested, how the process is done, if you want to know.
Please. Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah. So you have approximately, let's say, first the puppets. For the average Puppetoon during that early period, George had constructed either by hand or by machine somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 puppets or puppet parts for a single puppet tune, which is unheard of. And so you had that aspect where the craft had to be done. As far as the shooting is concerned, each frame of film had a puppet replaced, as I was saying. That's why it's called replacement or series puppet, with a different head. So let's say you had 100 different heads and 100 different legs. And the heads would be the vowels, A, E, I, O, U. And it would be the vowels put on the head one frame at a time to match the soundtrack. And those were done frame by frame. So now let's say, for instance, you have a puppet and you've gotten the head there, you've got the eyeballs in place, the arms are in place, the legs, which could be stretched or positioned, or the arm, whatever. So let's just say that's a single combination of puppets for a single frame. Okay, so now you're going to shoot that frame, you're going to click the clicker and you're going to shoot it. You're going to shoot it three times. You're going to shoot it with a red filter and a blue filter and a green filter. So you're going to shoot it three times because you're using Technicolor. But you're going to do something else. Technicolor required a tremendous amount of light to shoot. It was very hot on a set. You talk to people that worked on The Wizard of Oz or other motion pictures. I mean, it was very hot working on a Technicolor set. The film was very sensitive, but it needed a lot of light. And we had these huge arc lights, which is what was happening during that period on most motion pictures. And it was very dangerous too, because they were using electricity and you really had to be professional grips to handle these this set. It's no easy matter. And the camera was gigantic. But because there was so much light, it required a longer exposure in stop motion. So for each frame of film, it took a full minute to expose one frame of film. So to do one frame, it took three full minutes, let that sink in, 3 minutes to expose one frame of film. So in a single day, you were lucky to get maybe 16 seconds, maybe shot in a single day of work. And that was a full day of work. So it's about 300 frames roughly in a single day. And there were 12,000 frames that had to be shot in a puppet tune. That took 6 to 8 months to do easily, to do a puppet tune. And that didn't include the soundtrack, the design, the voice work, the music, all the elements that have to go into creating a puppet tune. So a tremendous amount of work and time compared to what we do today. We think what we do is so complicated, you know, with the computer and everything. I mean, now today it's so easy compared to what George had to do with those days with the puppet tunes. You can't even compare it, honestly.
So Arnie, what would happen in terms of dailies then, or rushes as we call them here in Europe? Because you wouldn't be able to see footage every day, would you? Because you'd have to go to the lab, that section would have to be broken off. So how frequently would he be able to watch his dailies?
My sense is it was something like once, let's see, it would take, let me think, it wasn't the next day or the day after. It could have been every third day, possibly, where they would be able to view these sections of the film. There was also a lot of problems. You know, I could see watching the puppet tunes, there were a lot of, they weren't able to redo things. In other words, there's artifacts that I end up having to restore, things in the frame that I'm not happy about. I've always wanted to remove the various hairs and different artifacts in the corners of the film. I don't like any of that. I made it so you don't see some of those artifacts because they're so annoying. Sometimes the hairs just come straight up into the frame and it's so annoying. And it took a tremendous amount of restoration work, which we can get into. And how, I mean, this one was a 4 or 5 year process just to do this last one. But, But so they weren't able to redo these things. Sometimes they had, when they shot it.
And for people who are listening, the reason for that hair wouldn't be because they were careless. It'd be because they couldn't really check the gates. Is that right? So they wouldn't really be able to open the camera after every take and check the gate, clean it, blow it through with air, and then do the next take because you had to wait. So that hair could have come in, or even might not have been a hair. It might have been just a piece of emulsion that's kind of scratched off.
Yeah, they didn't have the same capability. They certainly tried their best to do these things, but they didn't have the same quality control that you can have today.
Yeah.
So those were things that really annoyed me with some of these subjects that I've been able to finally rectify after all these years, on top of everything else that's being done in the restoration process, which is really a story in itself. So we can certainly talk about that. But there's nothing quite like seeing a puppetoon and working on a puppetoon. And there's no doubt about it. It's quite unique.
So how does the relationship work with Paramount then? Did you go to them and say, look, we can do this restoration if you allow us to release it? And because Paramount are famous for doing great restorations on their classic sort of television stuff as well as their movies.
No.
How did that work?
No, it didn't happen that way. I wish it did. I wish it was that easy. I was after, once Republic Pictures had the puppetoons, they had a lot of the Republic Library had them. And I was after Republic for years. I had Mrs. Powell write letters. We went back and forth trying to get them to, you know, allow me to do the various restorations, just to use the films, just to show the films. But they were very resistant. I think they knew they were eventually going to sell the library or something. And so when it went to Paramount, then I went, oh boy, now I have, you know, an opportunity to go back and know that, but no. Paramount was very behind the curve at the time. It took Paramount many, many years to get to where they are now. And now they're running on all four cylinders. They're doing just great, but it took years. Their archival department was a mess. Films were not being taken care of properly. They were doing terrible things to prints. I was in those departments watching them, and I couldn't believe, you know, here's War of the Worlds and it's being handled this way. You know, I just was in shock, really. So there's that part of it. Yeah, I spoke to various executives. I talked to this person and that person. The problem is nobody really had a handle on the archive. Nobody really knew what to do with it. And our cartoons, remember, you know, they don't mean anything. They're, you know, it's nothing. Short subjects were never considered important to begin with. So that was the other issue. So the way it happened was, after all these conversations I had with various executives over the years, and I always had a good rapport with the studios, and they always listened to me. They knew what I was doing. And I had done the Time Machine remake with Spielberg. I mean, I had some reputation in the industry. So I was able to have access, let's put it that way, which was helpful. I was doing a two-day tribute to George Powell on the Turner Classic Movies Network, which is shown here in the United States. It's called TCM. And I was on with Ben Mankiewicz, who replaced the Robert Osborne after Osborne had passed away, who I also knew. Ben interviewed me for that show. We did a two-day, we showed my films, the puppetoons, we showed about 8 George Powell features. So on that same day that I was doing that at Paramount, not too far from Paramount, actually, Jim Giannopoulos, who is the chairman of Paramount, was doing a series of interviews about the motion picture home. He's a big contributor to charities and the motion picture home here in Hollywood. And so I was able to get put in touch with Giannopoulos and to propose the idea of, how about I try to restore these puppetoons? No short subject had ever gone through this before at Paramount. It never happened. First time ever. And so uh, I proposed the idea, and it took a year and a half from the time I had that first conversation for Jim to say yes. And that was the beginning of it. And that was after, what, 40 years of waiting, basically. So he said yes, and then the apartments opened up to me, and now I have full reign over there at the studio as a result of it, and have had now for the past 6 or so years, I would say.
So are there any kind of astonishing gaps in the materials? Is there any kind of missing episodes or sequences that don't fully exist?
No, actually not.
That's quite lucky.
Every single Puppetoon exists. There are some soundtrack deficiencies in some places. I had to supply Paramount with a missing soundtrack on a couple of subjects, as I recall, where they needed some sound, and I happened to have a few prints, and we had to take it. And of course, the sound isn't quite as equalized on those tiny sections on a couple of subjects.
So what are the sound materials they have? I mean, do they have MagTrack or is it optical negs?
It's optical negatives.
That's not ideal. So where are the original MagTracks?
They're gone. They're destroyed. The MagTracks are long gone.
So once the optical neg was struck, I suppose for storage purposes, that was recycled.
That was recycled. And there's some damage. There is some damage to the optical tracks on several subjects. Visually, you can see the damage. We had to do equalization on some of those subjects to get them to sound. And if you'll hear it, you really can't tell. The average person will not be able to tell. But there's a slight timbre reduction in high fidelity in a couple of places as a result of that, because it would be totally unacceptable to listen to the noise, the track noise that existed on some of those subjects. They would be more criticized had we not done equalization. So we had to on a few subjects. But I was in touch with the fellow who headed up the archive when they were at Republic Pictures. I feel like I've spent my whole life doing this. I mean, I don't know. I must be crazy. But I spent a lot of time on the phone with that fellow, and I can't remember his name, just to ask him, how are things with the Puppetoons? He made a big effort to check every reel, make sure it all looked, you know, he said, yeah, everything's looking good. We just found this thing on Wilbur the Lion or whatever the subject was. He said, yeah, we're getting it all together. So I was kind of in touch with him during those years just to make sure everything was okay, you know? So I felt confident that the material was there, and so it is. The things that aren't there represent the early period. And this is a separate discussion, John, because George made at least 100 Puppetoons, I would say. Well, let's see, total 100. Let's say he made 50 in the United States. He made another 50 or more in Europe, easily. Could have made more. Some of them are just being discovered now. And I'm in touch with various archives in Germany, in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia. Very interesting story about this, by the way. What happened was, is during the war, during World War II, a lot of things got destroyed or taken in the spoils of war. You had artwork, you had jewelry, and you also had films. And these various films, especially at UFA, places like that, Germany and other places, I thought they were destroyed. Most people did, but no, they existed. They were put in a place somewhere. And what happened was, is after the war, some of these films started to get dispersed. And we found out that the Russians came in and they actually confiscated a lot of these spoils of war and took them to Russia. And now we're finding out that in Russia, in their archives, they actually have some of these films. And now we're trying to access them. And we have. We have. We just, my friend Jerry Beck just succeeded in getting one, a Betty Boop cartoon from Moscow that's in Russia. And that happened with one of these Puppetoons. We were able to, I was able to retrieve a beautiful Gasper color, Tale of the Melancholic King on Puppetoon 3, which you absolutely must see. 1934 subject. It was in the Czech Republic, which was in the communist side of that of the country, and now they've retained it. You see, and so there are films that are now just showing up in various countries, even in Germany, at the Kinemathic and other archives. I'm in touch with several right now, and there are films that they are just now discovering. It's very exciting. I call this film archaeology, what I'm doing.
Does this mean we can look forward to a Puppetoons Volume 4 then, Arnie?
without giving the announcement, I would say there's a good chance that might happen, yes.
That's amazing.
Yes, and that one will hopefully have some of these other ones that I'm just now starting to collate or accumulate. So I'm very early, when we're early on right at the moment, but that is a possibility, yes.
I'm going to ask Connor, do we have any Puppetoon materials ourselves in the Harryhausen Foundation? Because we do have some of the early fairy tales that Ray created as well. We have the fairy tale materials, and we've exhibited those in museums. So what can you tell us, Connor, about what we have in the archive?
In terms of material from the Puppetoons, contemporary material, there's not a massive amount. We do have photography that Ray kept, and it's something that we've spoken with our mutual friend Mike Hankin about. He's obviously keen to find out as much about the Puppetoons as he can from us. And I suppose where we were able to help is we have this photography, some of which is quite well known, but has Ray's notes on the back. So Ray, for example, there's the famous shot of all of the animators together, and Ray had actually written on the back who each person was, which is ideal for his type of research. But we don't have any of the Puppetoons models or any sort of the physical material. If you think about the time in Ray's life that he was working with George Pally's in his very, very early 20s, and it's his first, his first job, his first paid job as an animator. So it's that stage of his life, and it's something we always speak about when we're talking about Ray's biography. It always starts with King Kong, and then his early experiments in his garage with his parents' support, and then moves on to the Puppetoons. And of course, that was interrupted by World War II. Sort of closest experience with the Puppetoons since working with the foundation has actually been in Los Angeles when we visited Screen Novelties. Mark Caballero and Seamus Walsh, who are just the greatest guy, the lovely guys. They spent a day with us showing us around their studio. And they obviously, for anyone that doesn't know, they helped Ray complete the story of the tortoise and the hare back in 2002. And they have some of the models from Western Days on display in their studio. They have the horse models there. And they told us that they, when they were working with Ray, they were peppering him with questions about his time working with George Pal and working at the Puppetoons. That's obviously something that's inspired them a massive amount. And I suppose for Ray's later career, as John mentioned there, the fairy tales, that's the closest Ray ever got to doing anything that was sort of remotely similar to the Puppetoons, with the replacement heads, although it wasn't quite to the extent of thousands of replacement models. Ray's Mother Goose stories and fairy tales had these replacement heads for different facial expressions, where he used an 8-frame dissolve to kind of transition. Yeah. Between these looks on the characters' faces. But it's a very interesting part. I think I'm quite interested in Ray's formative experiences and the impact that this first job had upon him, and everything that he learned, and the impact that had on his later career. And obviously Ray went on to shape his own visions, but I suppose he learned a lot about the practicalities of working with a team and working with a big studio full of people at that very young age. I think he was only 19 or 20 when he first met George Pal, which is which is fascinating too. We know how focused he was as a teenager on learning this craft and on getting into the business.
So Arnie, do you have any idea of where all the, because we have a lot of stuff at the Harryhausen Foundation. We have 50,000 items. We have most of the creatures and artwork and so on. Where are the puppetoons?
They're all over the place. They're in many, many places. I have a couple right here. I can actually show you a couple of things right now if you're interested.
Oh, wow.
I have to get up to do it. This, George used to take this. He used to take this on various tours. In fact, there's photographs of him holding this puppet. Mrs. Powell gave me these. I had quite a few things that Mrs. Powell gave me. And this is one of them. Some of them I've sold because I was afraid to keep them because of their delicacies. But this kind of is a demonstration. He kind of showed this to show that, you know, the head would come off the puppet, you know, in a way. But this is very crude way of showing it because the eyeballs would change or the arms would change. But each part, you know, he would just use this as sort of an example of how you would you would replace different section of the puppet, so he would be able to take it apart and just kind of give a general idea.
It's in good condition, Mark. Has it been Arnie? Has it been restored at all? Or
no? Now this is not a puppetoon that was used. Can I get this straight with this camera? Here we go. This is not the size of a puppetoon. Oh. I use this as an example to show the look and the style. This is the actual puppetoon.
Well, I thought they looked quite big. So that makes more sense now, yes.
Yeah. Now, they had to work with these tiny, tiny little puppets.
Wow.
And when you see them blown up on a screen the size of Radio City Music Hall, you know, it's really quite amazing that the puppets were so tiny. And they were able to, now this part, it doesn't come apart. This has all been fused together. But George would make these. He made hundreds of these and he gave them out to people. And he had the puppetoons insignia on them. And he would, a lot of people got these. I was given these by Mrs. Powell. And I actually got them from Duke Goldstone as well. Mark bought his at an auction, and there are other auctions where people have been able to buy them, and they're all over the place. But I like to show this to show the comparison between, you know, what this is to this is, just to give them an idea of what the size of the puppet was. I have a few other puppets, but it'll take too much time to get through all of these. But basically, it kind of gives you an idea. The puppets are all over the world. People that have them prized having them because they're quite a rarity to be able to have one of these. And so people have been in touch with me over the years who told me, my father bought one or given one or I have it. And I've heard this from a number of people that you know, still have these puppets. So if we do some kind of an exhibit, I'm going to have to call on, of course, Mark and a lot of other people that have these puppets that bought them at auction and try to accumulate a few of them to show. We have various posters and there's various toys, there's various books that were written. There's all sorts of material. When I talk, I'd like to be able to tell people, okay, now I can identify this person and this person, this person. I'm asked all the time, even by the Academy, you know, did this person work? What I've done is I've accumulated a list. It's in the Puppetoon movie, and I have a credit crawl on Puppetoon 2 and 3. And I've accumulated a list of as many people who were worked on the Puppetoons. There's hundreds of people, you know, that were working there, you know, including Willis O'Brien and Ray and many others that worked with George. And also the voice people. All the people that did the voices of the puppetoons. I'm just now discovering the various actors that were doing the voices for the various puppetoons. A fellow named Keith Scott has written a book on cartoon voices. He's terrific. He lives in Australia, although he's from the United States, and he has been very, very helpful. And so I've been able to collate in this volume three, there's a booklet. I made a 20-page booklet, beautifully done, and it kind of goes through a bit of the history. And also what I did is I created a kind of a bibliography, which is one of the things I try to do with this. Each subject has a full bibliography of everyone that worked on it, the detail of the technical people, as many as I could discover, the voice people, some material that's not been released before. So this really represents the first time these things have been bibliographied in a way which is from an educational point of view. And I did this with Puppetoon 2 as well, but it's even more complete now with Puppetoon 3. So this is quite a book. This is quite an amazing part of this release, which, by the way, is this right here.
That's amazing. So where can people order it now? Because people who are watching now, where's the best place for them to get hold of their Volume 3 copy?
It's puppetoon.net. Puppetoon.net. It'll eventually be on Amazon. It is, but right now I'm kind of keeping it close to the vest, mainly because I'm like trying to recoup as much of the investment as possible. It's very expensive to do this project. More than you could. More money was spent than actually we actually had. I mean, I had to basically dig down and spend my own money to do a lot of it. Because there's no money in the world that can really, really restore properly that you can actually get people to pay for. And what we did with the restoration on this is beyond, it's actually being called the, some people are calling this the Blu-ray of the year already. It's only being called that. It rivals some of the best restorations ever done on a cartoon subject, and some say period. The restorations on this are absolutely stunning, both in terms of the quality of the successive negatives and the quality of the restorations in terms of the cleaning of them and the grading of them, because I had it done by professionals, and they are absolutely stunning. One reviewer said it's like a Technicolor Toyland, where the colors are so vivid, it's almost like watching 3D. Wow. That's how it was characterized.
Well, we'll put a link in the video below here so people can directly order all of those. And can they get Puppetoons 1 and 2? Are they still available? Do you have any left?
Puppetoon 2 is on the tail end, but there are some available, but not for long. I have a very limited supply, but it's still available. Puppetoon 1 is out of print. But again, I have a bit of a surprise coming, which is I'm hinting at to you, in the next couple of months, I'm going to make an announcement, that might satisfy people regarding, Puppetoon 1. That's coming. So,
Us know about that, because we'll do as much championing of your releases as we possibly can. And we have a lot of followers here on the various socials. And listen, before you go, just something I can't not ask you about. And we can see the poster behind. Everyone's a massive fan of the Time Machine. Of course they are. And I've got all the various soundtracks from the original.
Yep.
And I've even got the reissue soundtrack for the remake that you
were involved
in
as well.
Because there's and I love the remake as well with Guy Pearce. What was it like for you working on the Time Machine remake with Steven Spielberg, of course?
Oh, it was amazing. That's a story for almost for another broadcast.
Please come back. Please come back. We'd love you to speak to us about Time Machine.
Time Machine is a discussion unto itself. As it's what's so interesting is every single feature of George is a discussion unto itself. Time Machine, of course, is of particular importance because for me, that was the movie. And by the way, I didn't have a chance to say this, but please give me a moment to just express this to you, both in terms of George Powell and Ray Harryhausen, because I think I have to get this out so you can hear this, okay? Very important. First with George, I was 9 years old. I saw the Time Machine in a movie theater in Miami Beach, Florida. It was at the Carib Theater. I remember it because it was impossible not to be stricken by that film. It was awe-inspiring to see it as a 9-year-old watching it for the first time was stunning. It was like boyhood wonder in spades. And so that was a great influence for me, was that. In 1958, which was 2 years or a year before I saw The Time Machine, I saw The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Now, when Ray was with me, I spent so much time, again, you have to imagine, here I am, basically a fan, like all of you, with my heroes. When I grew up, it was Walt Disney, it was George Pal, it was Ray Harryhausen, and kind of in a way, it was Cecil B. DeMille, because those are kind of the people that kind of influenced me as a kid. Isn't it amazing that all of them coalesced around George Pal? He worked with Ray. Cecil B. DeMille was essential to George's getting and moving on with When Worlds Collide and War of the Worlds at Paramount. Walt Disney, he was close friends with. I met Walt Disney when I was 12 years old, by the way, at Disneyland. All my dreams as a kid came true for me in my life because I was able to fulfill this passion that I had as a kid. I know John Landis, he's my age. He too had the same experience when he saw The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. I was 8 years old when I saw it. I remember the theater, it was the Lincoln Theater in Miami Beach because that's where I grew up. I watched that film over and over again. I was in the movie theater. They didn't kick me out. The ushers let kids stay in movie theaters in those days. You know, they were sweeping the floor, the popcorn and everything. And I'm the little kid and they just let me stay there. And I watched it over and over and over again that day. And I came back to the theater again to see it. It was unbelievably life-changing. I just don't know how, I just want your viewers and listeners to appreciate what it's like for an eight-year-old to see it for the first time on a movie screen in a movie theater for the first time. There was nothing, nothing like seeing it for the first time. When that Cyclops comes out and that unbelievable Bernard Herrmann score, which I told Ray how fortunate he was to have Bernard Herrmann do the score for four of his films. I mean, that was one of the biggest really achievements, I'm telling you, in his career, to be able to get that incredible score. That score more than made that film. And then I became friends later on with Torrin Thatcher, who was in the film. In later years, I was in touch with Torrin. I was in touch with Curran Matthews when the film, at that time, I had these discussions with them. It's hard for me to express what that feels like, the incredible thing, because these films made John, me, Peter, Stephen, George into who we are. You saw it at your tribute that you did when you did it in England. We would not be the people we are today without Ray, without George, without Walt. They made us who we are. They made us love life, see the possibilities of tomorrow, see the beauty in the world, inspire us to great imagination. There's nothing that can compare to that. I don't know if it exists today the way it did for us at that time, but it was a very special time, a very special place. Time Machine, we can talk about in another session because there's so much to talk about, so much.
We'd love to talk to you about that because Ray wanted to make a version of Time Machine himself as well.
Ray told me, we had so many discussions. Ray and George wanted to work together. They talked about doing films together throughout the years. They always were coming back. I would like to know, actually would like to know which specific projects other than War of the Worlds or Time Machine. I know those films, but there were films that they wanted to do together that never happened, and never happened because George was so busy and Ray was so busy, you know, but they always were discussing the possibilities. I would love to have seen that happen. I love it if it could have happened. It would have been really, really amazing, but it never did. But he regretted that. Ray regretted that when we had our talk, the day we did our talk, which is on, you'll see some on the on Papa Toon 3. We did it, by the way, at Mrs. Powell's house.
I think Food of the Gods might have been one they tried to work on. It's in my book. I won't spoil it for you. You'll see it when it comes along. But yeah, they did try and get things together. How wonderful.
You were working.
That's definitely. Yeah.
Were you able to? How much time did you spend with Ray? Did you spend some good time with him?
Yeah, I knew Ray since the late 1980s. So I contacted him as a film student when I was at the London Film School. His name was in the telephone directory, R. Harryhausen. I rang him up and said, "Oh, I'd like to do a documentary about your life and career." And so we kind of clicked. And then over the years, he followed my work. I went into sort of features and documentaries and so on. But I was never an animator, but I was always kind of active producer and interested in fantasy cinema. And then the last few years he was alive, I recorded commentaries with him for his films because he hadn't recorded commentaries for the majority of his movies. And
so
he asked me to become a trustee of his foundation.
But when their films are released, are they on the various films, the commentaries?
On some of them, yeah. So we've licensed I've gifted them all to the foundation. So some of them have been licensed out to other movies like, I think, 1 Million Years BC and Valley of Guanji and First Men in the Moon. And but I'm constantly with you chatting to the folks down at Republic. I'm constantly chatting to the good folks down at the Warner Archive to get them to do a 4K of Clash of the Titans, because we keep finding new things like test footage for Pegasus. And I keep reminding the folks down here, if you want to do a 4K, we've still got stuff for you.
I've been trying to get them to do I want them to do a Time Machine 4K also.
Yes, that would be
absolutely, because it's a big, you know, it's one of their biggest titles. Yeah. And you know, I want to be able to do a showing. We're talking about a whole, you should know about this. So I'm talking to a fellow. Are you aware of the big showing we did for the, oh my God, was that the 50th anniversary of the Time Machine? It was the 35th, or I think it may have been the 35th anniversary. We did it downtown Los Angeles. Do you remember that?
It does ring a bell, yeah.
And there were 2,000 people that came, and we had the actual Time Machine on the stage. Well, the fellow that did it contacted me about possibly doing this again for maybe the 65th anniversary, doing this Time Machine anniversary, and he'd like to do others. I said, let's do Ray Harryhausen. Let's do a Walt Disney. So I called it Flights of Fantasy. It's the name of it. It's going to be hopefully a series of fantasy films that we're going to do in Los Angeles with elements that we can bring on the stage, stars, people associated with the films, and try to do some kind of a series. So that is something we're working on.
Well, we'd love to be involved in that. We have loads of assets that we can help you with and supply. So
definitely do want to do a Harryhausen. We have to discuss which is the film, you know, for me, it's, I know what I want to do, but, you know, I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, look, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Golden Voyage of Sinbad. So we have different high definition screenings of Golden Voyage of Sinbad happening in cinemas in this country with some of the actors, with Caroline Monroe. So.
Oh, yeah. What about the Seventh Voyage? Can you get a 4K of that?
There is a 4K of that. So the folks down at Sony Pictures have created the 4K of that, of Jason, of First Men in the Moon, and I think of Three Worlds of Gulliver. Okay. So there are four 4Ks DCPs available. We had a DCP premiere of the 4K of First Men in the Moon in 2019 at Regent Street Cinema. So they help us with access to those sorts of things. So if you plug us into your festival, we can sort you out with Ray loved all that as well. I was with him in the house when Grover Crisp contacted him from Sony, and he said to me, I won't do the accent. He said, Grover Crisp has asked me, should I remove this, that, and the other from the film? And I said, such as what? You know, and keeping the frame stable and removing some dirt and grit. And there was a couple of surface gauges, I think, that had flashed in. But he said, what about removing the strings, the wires off the harpies? And I was like, oh, no, I don't think so. And
no,
he said,
no.
Well, I told him he should. He said, I told him he should. And I was like, well, it's not for me to contradict you.
Ray said
I
that?
Wouldn't. He said to remove the wires off the harpies. Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. No, that's a very interesting. I had the same controversy with the War of the Worlds strings, people that saw the strings, but it's been removed. Mm. They've been removed. And if George was alive and Ray, that proves my point. You've proven the point. If they were alive, yep, they would want that because they wanted the very best artistic achievement for their special effects. They don't want to see strings. They want it, come on.
Well, we do. We want to see it. And I think you, Arnie, you want to see it secretly.
We want to see what? The strings?
Yeah, I want to see the strings.
So we want to see it from a purist perspective. Yes, yep, we want to see what it was. But remember, when some of these films were made, that was not the intention.
No.
Certainly with War of the Worlds, it was not George's intention and special effect, Gordon Jennings' intention to see those strings when they made the film. In fact, when they shot it, they made it slightly darker. They used the contrast negative in successive negative. And in some of the early prints that were shown, you didn't see the strings quite as prominently as you did in the later Eastman prints. It was the Eastman prints with it, which is what we all saw. We saw those things. But in the original Technicolor versions, very few of those prints exist anymore. You couldn't see them. So I'm really happy to hear this, that Ray said that, because I always feel if you're a special effect person or you're a person making a film, can you imagine if Stanley Kubrick would see a string or something? I mean, he would be he was like so fastidious about everything, you know?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. So maybe you have two versions. You have the purest version over here, and then you have the new technology version over here, you know?
So, well, Ray colored some of his early films. So, you know, the classic black and white films from Columbia Pictures, Earth versus the Flying Saucers, 20 Million Miles to Earth. And they were colored under Ray's supervision, and both versions are available. So on Blu-ray, you can see the black and white version or the color version.
Oh,
take your pick. And Ray enjoyed seeing them in color. So
he approved
the colorization. So he was
he
there.
Did approve it.
Yes. So people always say, why did Ray wouldn't have allowed that? And I said, he approved it. He would have shot on color if he was allowed to with the budgets that they had, but Charles Schneer wasn't able to get a big enough budget for those pictures. So goes to show you.
I know. And if George was alive, you'd hear the same thing from him. I mean, remember, these are pioneers. These were innovators. Think about what Walt Disney did in his career. He was always striving for the greatest, the best, everything. They would absolutely want these films to have that quality. Today, if they were alive, oh my God, I just can't imagine what George would say on some of these films. He was alive to see things like Star Wars and Close Encounters, but he would be all in. George would be all in on this, absolutely. No question in my mind. Maybe not quite as far as the storytelling. I think we've lost a little of the basics that George was doing in those early films than today, because it shouldn't be special effects from one end to the other, you know. But I think he would appreciate what's happening. No question about it.
Oh, look, Bess, it's been marvelous. Thanks for taking up so much of your time to chat with us today about Puppetoons.
Anyway, I just so enjoy seeing you, John. I thank you for your work. Oh, I thank you for what you've been doing with the foundation. I loved Ray. I loved Diana. It's very sad that they're not here. Terribly sad. And I so appreciate your keeping the mantle going as you've been doing and as Connor has been doing. You deserve a great deal of credit for what you're doing. Enormous credit, really, because someone has to do this. Someone has to carry on. I won't live forever. And somebody has to do this from generation to generation, and you're doing your share. Very much appreciated. So I want to thank you for that, both of you.
I know, I'm enormously flattered, and you know, I feel privileged to chat to you tonight to hear your wonderful stories of George, and of course your own brilliant work as well. So let's do it again.
The Puppetoon Movie Volume 3 Blu-ray has got everybody talking. Order yours today at puppetoon.net.
Well, that was fantastic. Of course, Arnie there was speaking about Volume 3 of the Puppetoons. We'd love to come back for Volumes 1, 2 and 3 of our chats with Arnie, because I think he's a man we need to speak to a lot more about George Powell and his work. And of course, we've got a copy of Puppetoons Volume 3 to give away here on the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation podcast. And you can do that by subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can see the caption below and commenting below the video. And Connor, there's some other exciting Puppetoons news as well, isn't there?
Yes, since our conversation with Arnie, I think he hinted in this during our chat that he had some news to reveal. We can now share this, that the original Puppetoons movie from the 1980s will also be released on Blu-ray very soon. The Puppetoons movie was, you know, for a long while the only way you could see some of these original films. And if you'd head to puppetoon.org, you'll be able to see more. Arnie is on all of the social media pages. He's very active on Facebook. And you can check out in the show notes for this podcast and find out some more information on how to see Puppetoons movies 1, 2, and 3. He's really making all of this this gold mine of animated films available once more. And yeah, please support Arnie, and we'll share further information and progress on how his restoration program is coming along. I think it's interesting, John, because unlike our archive, Arnie's really dealing with the original films and he's making those available, whereas we're restoring and preserving Ray Harryhausen's vast collection of models and documents and photography and everything else. Kind of similar to our chat with Jamie Anderson from the Jerry Anderson archives some months ago. It's interesting, I suppose, the different status of animation archives around the world. Some are very object heavy and some are more delving more into the film archives and things that are no longer widely available to the public.
Absolutely. And I think those Puppetoons are out there somewhere. So if you've got a Puppetoon or you've got any material, then why not share it? Let us know, tag us in, because we'd like to know. It's not our job to reunite all the Puppetoons, but out there, fans, you can maybe let Arnie know what you've got. And as you rightly say, Connor, he's developing the actual films, the original camera negatives from the Paramount Studios archive, which is very exciting. You can find out more about Arnie in the notes beneath this program. And if you'd like to find out more about us, check us out at rayharryhausen.com, where you can find our social media links and all of the podcasts too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Copyright in the Ray Harryhausen podcast is owned by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, a registered Scottish charity, number SC001419, 2024. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part without written permission from the Foundation. The views expressed within these podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of the Foundation, its trustees or employees. For further terms and conditions, please contact us at rayharryhausen.com, where you can find our Facebook, Instagram and X links. Thank you.